Welcome to It Might Just Be Me, the podcast. I'm Ray Richardson. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm Ray Richardson of The Ray Richardson Show, I should say. You can catch me weekday mornings from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Time at News Talk WLOB and the Lobster Radio Network. Our website is WLOBradio.com, where we do live streaming. This is our 16th podcast, and I like to say I'm grateful. I wake up every morning in a state of gratitude. I'm married to the best person I've ever met. I've had a life that I couldn't have dreamed of. So I wake up every day in gratitude. And I want to say once again, I am so grateful to everybody who's been downloading the podcast. We've been overwhelmed. In fact, I said last week the stats were 40% in Maine, 60% elsewhere. The stats now are 35% in Maine and 65% elsewhere. And elsewhere is just growing. We actually have been downloaded in all 50 states now. So we are very grateful to all of you for tuning in. Today we have a wonderful guest. If you're from Maine, you know him immediately. All you have to do is say his name, and you know who he is and what he's done. His name is Bill Green, and we know him as Bill Green's Maine, or it should be Maine's Bill Green. Bill, good morning.
Good morning, Ray. Good morning, everyone. How you doing?
Yeah, we're fabulous. Couldn't be better.
What's the tagline on It Might Just Be Me?
Well, at my very first book, which was 12, 15 years ago, it was called It Might Just Be Me, But I Don't Think So. And so Didi was like, Didi loved that book. In fact, I think it was my wife, Didi.
I have that book.
And you do?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
I bought it off you at the Cumberland Fair.
Oh, my goodness.
Always in September.
Yeah. Yes, I have a photograph of you looking through it.
And really?
I said, hey, can I take a photograph? And you said, absolutely, but you can't use it for promotional because you were at News Center Maine at the time. And I said, no, just for the heck of it. You know, you're Bill Green and you're reading my book. That was kind of cool.
You can use it now.
Yeah, I can use it now. No big deal. So, Bill, everybody in Maine knows you for 40 years. Is that right?
Well, my TV career started as a TV cameraman in 1972 at WLBZ. I was a freshman at the University of Maine. I worked 3.5 years behind the scenes, much of the time with a local legend named Eddie Driscoll, who's an old vaudeville performer. I learned so much from Eddie. And then my senior year in college, which was my fifth year, took me a little longer than some students, I was a little local sportscaster. A guy named Bob Steele left. He would later be very influential at the Poynter Institute for Journalistic Ethics, and I replaced Bob as the sportscaster. So I was a 21-year-old sportscaster in a three-piece suit and just going to beat heck.
Yeah.
Wild, right? Just trying to cover everything. I wasn't any good at producing it, so it was never organized. It was just, in fact, Lee Montville was a great writer. I really love Lee.
Remember Lee Montville, sure.
And he was a Boston Globe guy. He had a place somewhere. He's watching me one night, and I'm racing, and I'm doing all this stuff, and he kind of was laughing at my style, but if you like sports, you like what I did because you got sports. And I got to the sports scores, which I had ripped off the wire. For some of you old people know what that means. I started reading the scores and I went, oh, no, these are last night's scores. I didn't know what to do, so I crinkled them up and threw them over my shoulder. I said, they'll be in the paper in the morning. And Lee thought that was about the funniest thing he'd ever seen. But I was balls to the walls. This is a podcast, I can say. I was just trying to cover everything.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what we do here with the morning show.
Yep.
I don't keep up with it. We don't use notes. And other than having scheduled guests, there's no agenda except that the guest that comes in. But people say we hit about 70 subjects in 4 hours. I don't know if that's true.
Yep.
I don't keep up with it. But, wherever the mood or moment takes us.
Yeah, I think, good TV, good radio, you're still the friend of the viewer or listener. And in writing, the reader, put your voice in it. I'm a moderate guy, I think, and I try to be just conversational and fun, like you're having a cup of coffee with me. And that was always my style during my broadcasting career, which went till 2019 for people who aren't from here. I had 44 years on the air.
Yeah, which is just incredible. You're right about speaking like you talk and being who you are when you write. I wrote newspaper columns for 5 newspapers for, 8 years, something like maybe 10 years. And when I first started doing it, I had written 4, and I called the editor and I said, hey, I really appreciate the opportunity, but I just can't do this. And they're like, what's wrong? This is fine. And I'm like, it's not me. And the editor said, he had heard me. What had me write for them was he had heard me speak at an event. He said, why don't you just write like you talk? He said, people seem to want to hear you. So that's what I started doing. And after that, it was fine. And now I've written 5 books and blah, 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 blah.
I try to write like I talk. The problem is you can't punctuate the way I talk. And you know, in Siri, what's the spell correcting device on your computer?
Yeah.
When you're from Maine, it doesn't even accept a lot of our words, like Gulf Haggis. It doesn't know where you are, you know. So Madamus Contis, I can't think of a word, but I was trying to say some street into my car GPS the other day, and it didn't. Oh, Scott Dyer Road in Cape Elizabeth, and it couldn't get Dyer.
Right.
You know, so I had a Scott D-Y-E-R, and it did take the spelling and, you know, take me to the place I was going. But a lot of Maine words, you know, they're not in the dictionary yet.
Well, we have a lot of that. Didi will tell you I like to voice type whenever I'm texting or anything like
sure.
that.
Oh, and forget about it.
Just get very frustrated with the device. And
forget about it.
Yeah, so it's pretty crazy. Pretty crazy.
They haven't figured us out yet, Ray, in Maine.
So did you always want to be a broadcaster?
No,
was that your thing?
I had no mentoring. My dad was a railroad brakeman. Great guy. Great storyteller. My father was the best storyteller. My mother was from England, and she immigrated to the United States and became a passionate American. She was made fun of for her accent, which if it's English, you got to step up. But,
right.
you know, she got rid of that, and she joined the WACS during World War II, and then Women's Auxiliary Corps became, I can't remember what it was. Women's Auxiliary Corps was WAX,
right.
and then the Women's Army Corps, WAC, and she went from WACS to WACS and met my dad and got married during World War II, you know, stateside.
Right.
Yep.
Wow, that's an incredible story. Yep. So you were at UMaine. And
yeah, I was a high school kid, a pretty good baseball player, average football player, but I loved it. And then I went to get out of, so I didn't have a strong mentoring at home. You know, blue collar family, dad was a union worker, good guy, but, you know, they didn't say sit down and study every night. In fact, my father said one time, and I love my father to death. It's like I'm my father sitting here talking to you, so I'm not criticizing him. He said, don't expect me to give any money to go to college. And yet I knew I was going to college, but, you know, that's not exactly what you see today when people are buying their way into USC on the rowing team.
Right.
But so I, you know, I had some struggles from 18, 19, 20. You know, I didn't have any money. I, you know, living in an apartment, moving back home. It was kind of a mess. But I got the job at Channel 2. I'll tell you a long story. I'm working as the meat man at McDonald's, and a guy named Billy Ayer is skiing behind a car at the party. Billy was the toughest kid in town. He catches a ski tip, flies into the wood, and breaks his collarbone, right? Hits a tree.
Right.
And they're going to fire him because he can't come in to do the maintenance work. And I said, well, geez, don't fire him. He'll be back in 6 weeks. He was an old guy. He was like 24 or 5, and he had a kid. And I said, you know, I said, I can't fix anything, but I can come in, light the burners, and wash the windows. I'll be the maintenance man. So they, oh, okay, that's good. So, and the first day, and then at lunchtime, we didn't have anybody could run the grill. I could cook 96 hamburgers at a time on this split grill with a grease trough in the middle, put 6 down, pick 6 up. And we also had, not only do we have a meat man, we had a bun man and a dress man, right? So I'd flip 6 hamburgers onto the buns, and Dick Ryan, who I played football with, would dress them, and Brad Halsey would flip. You know, we could run some burgers back then. And so they needed a guy on the grill. So I said, okay, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll come in early, I'll open up, and then I'll clean up. I'll come on the floor and cook. And the big difference was the maintenance man got a free lunch. And how many Filet-O-Fish with orange sodas, which was my favorite McDonald's meal. Yeah, this is not much of a guess you got here today, right? So we started doing that, and then the big high school basketball tournament was coming up. A friend came, and I ran out. And she said, oh, I'm hungry. Could I get some? And, you know, so I got her French fries and a Coke. Ran out the front door, ordered French fries and a Coke. And the guy got me large fries instead of small fries. I said, oh, Eddie, I wanted small fries because large fries were like $1.05, and I had a $20 bill and 63 cents. Small fries was 63. And I said, call them small fries because I want to break my 20. And he did, and they fired us both. And that was on Tuesday, and I was devastated because I had been fired for stealing, which, you know, when you're a blue-collar kid from Maine and you've been caught stealing, this is horrible.
It's
you
not
know,
good.
How are you going to defend you? I'll never be employed again. I was 18 years old. No one would ever employ a thief. And my father heard the story, and bless his heart, he said, to hell with them. Just go get another job. And I was trying to get a job loading trucks for $2.25 an hour. And this guy goes, well, I know a job that I didn't want, but Channel 2's looking for a cameraman. But he only pays minimum wage, which was $1.70. And I thought, Hollywood. I thought, oh, man. I got the job. And, you know, $1, 48 hours a week at $1.70. And I loved every second of it for 48 years. And I, you know, the first night they asked me if I'd stay late, run camera for the news. And, you know, I couldn't run camera, but I could hold it. And the light came on, and I literally had a thought, I'm going to do this till I'm 65. And I did it till I was 66. So a tremendous life, as you say, grateful for everything that's come my way. Great ride, you know, met a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. Right.
You know, got around, you know.
But you were on my morning show today, the day we taped this podcast, and you were talking about meeting Ted Williams and and Bud Levitt, who is a legendary sports writer, and all
Tom
these
Brady,
great, and
you Tom, know what I mean? Yeah. But you know, when you're a middle market guy like Portland, Maine is, you get 2 minutes, or you're in a room with him for a press conference for 15 minutes. I can't remember his name. The women's basketball coach at UConn, Gino Auriemma.
Yeah, right.
We had a woman from Maine who ended up coaching Duke, Joanne McCauley. She was Palumbo as a kid. She went to Maine to Michigan State, and she went into UConn. So I went down to do a story on her, and she beat him by 13 at UConn.
I remember.
Great win, right? And they cleared out. You know, her entourage is gone. And Auriemma sat at that press conference for 20 minutes. All by himself, like all the other guys have deadlines. I'm kind of in the room with him, and he was a gym rat. He loved the game. He'd gotten his butt kicked, and he was sitting there trying to think about it, like why. Like you think, well, he's got to go with raise some money off millionaires or everything's important, you know. But I really liked him because he got beat and it hurt.
Oh yeah, you know, was focused. That's what makes him so great.
Yeah.
He loves the game. That's what's most important is the game.
Yeah.
What have they won, like 11
a
championships?
But,
I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, but you get glimpses of people.
Yeah,
so
sure.
I don't know anybody. Nobody's really my friend, but, you know, you name a walk of life, I probably have a glimpse of some people. And maybe a somewhat informal glimpse because, you know, we're just Maine and we can't hurt anybody. So they might let their guards down a little bit.
Right.
You know, our astronauts, Chris Cassidy and Jessica Meir, you know, I know them, you know, and it's fun to know them. And that's probably the one thing in retirement. I've been making an effort to go out and hear people speak or, you know, reaching out to people and just say, hey, you know, I'm watching you here. And, you know, some of them are kids working on TV on the other channels.
Right.
You know, Owen Kinsley. Hey, Owen, watched your show tonight. I thought you did a good job. You know, or I ran into him at a Maine Celtics game. But, you know, stop and say hello and, hey, you're doing a good job. And, you know, I like knowing who these people are.
Yeah, it's fun. Absolutely. You just brought up Jessica Meir. My brother's niece by marriage is her best friend.
Oh, no kidding.
And so.
Now, where? Down in NASA? Or up in
Caribou? No. Up in Caribou.
Okay.
And that's where they're all from.
Yeah,
My sister-in-law Jane's from Caribou.
Okay.
So I guess she.
I like your sister-in-law Jane already.
Yes, of course. She's good. She's good people. Very good people. Well, the people from the county are good people.
Who'd she pick for?
You know, I don't know, but she did, though.
I've rudely ruined your story.
No.
My wife's
from
Holton. And
she was valedictorian at Caribou High School in, was it 80?
Was she ahead of Jessica Meir?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know the answer to that. No. My sister-in-law, Jane, was
84 or 85.
Well, say that again?
It must have been 84 or 85.
Something like that, because that's roughly around the time you were. That's my wife, Dee Dee, that jumped on for a second.
So I have a county joke.
Okay.
Like, you know how a guy will ask a girl her sign, like to get a conversation, hey, what's your sign?
You know, I've never done that my entire life.
I know, neither have I. But you're ruining my story. I'm setting it up. If you're from the county and the guy finds out you're from the county, my wife says that he'll say, who'd you pick for?
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
That's why I throw
out. Oh, no, absolutely. All the county kids did that. So it's Erin, I believe, is her name, my brother's niece.
Okay, brother's niece. Yeah,
yeah. Niece by marriage. You know, Jane. She's Jane's niece. I think Jessica Meir left Uzbekistan. I think that's where she flew out of when she went to the space station. So Erin literally went over there for 2 weeks with her. They're that close.
Was it you talking about that on the air? Or
Yeah, I was
somebody was talking about
I was
that.
Talking about that on the air a while back. And so my brother, who lives down in Florida, he was giving me this blow-by-blow because it's exciting. You know, astronaut, I don't care. You know, I grew up about an hour from Cape Kennedy. So we always saw the rockets taking off growing up and that kind of stuff.
I've never seen a rocket take off.
Really?
It's on my bucket list.
Yeah, it's very, very cool. There's just no getting around it. And, you know, so I'm always excited about astronauts because it's just so cool.
Good, because I am too. I think they are magical.
Yeah, so he was giving me a blow-by-blow because, you know, Aaron was keeping them up to date on what was happening and that kind of stuff. And it was just a very cool experience because going off into space is, you know, it's some people see it as mundane, but it's still very dangerous and very exciting.
Chris Cassidy from York, Maine, he was out there with Luca, the Italian astronaut, whose helmet started filling up with water, and they say that Chris saved him.
Yeah.
You know, grabbed him, threw him in
the
airlock. Just like Star Trek, man. No, I do. I love that stuff. I want to be a hero. I want to jump in my car and drive to you in the night when you have a flat tire and change it. You know, there's no real heroism in my life, but that's my nature. That probably tells you something about me. You
know, that's my nature too.
Get up, salute the flag.
Yeah.
Go save somebody. Have lunch.
Yeah, that's my nature too. And it was really funny in my life. I've talked about this on air. In fact, we pretty much share our life here. My kids all their life, whenever anything was going on, my circle of people, something's going on, I can always fix it. I've done that since I was in seventh grade. I just can see what the solution is and go fix it.
And I can't. I go and make things worse, but I'm energetic and trying to be helpful.
So as my kids got older and, you know, they got married and that kind of stuff, whenever something would happen, I'd just fix it. And so at one point, my daughter Lizzie said to me, she was been married about a year, and she said, "Hey, Dad, remember how you told us how strong you and Mom have always been?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Why was that?" And I said, "Well, we lived in Maine. We didn't know a soul. You know, we were here for a year before my brother moved up. So we just had each other to rely on. And so we had to solve everything ourselves. You know, it wasn't like in the day of email and cell phone and, you know, FaceTime and that kind of stuff." And she said, "Exactly. That made you really strong. You guys have been married 39 years, really strong." I said, "Yep." And she said, "Well, Justin and I need to figure out how we solve our problems, because every time you solve one, it's really wonderful, but we didn't solve it. So we don't know how to do that now."
Yeah.
So I had to step away and just say, "Okay, I tell you what, kids," because all our kids are grown and married and happy. "And if you need me, all you have to do is call. But from now on, you have to call. I won't step in ahead of time." You know, if, like, my daughter Leela had a flat tire, and before she could call me, I had already called the repair shop and was getting her car towed.
Yeah.
You know, so it has changed the dynamic. But I know what you're talking about, because jumping in and wanting to help people, you know, I'm grateful. My life is full of gratitude.
I had stuff tied down on my truck yesterday going to church because the yard sale's coming up, and I didn't do a good job. And so I had to pull over and tie something down. I pulled in a new yard, and the guy's painting a house. He's moving a ladder. I said, "Can I help you move the ladder?" You know, he goes, "No, I got it." You know, but I mean, I drove in his, you know, little light place, and I'm an idiot that way. But hey, I'm trying to be happy.
I know how it is, you know. So, but I think it comes from having a life of gratitude. You know, I've gotten to live out my dreams. When Dee Dee and I got married, I said, "What do you want to do?" And she said, I want to be a good wife, and I want to be a good mom, and I want to be a good grandmother." And she's certainly been all of those things. She asked me what I wanted to do. I said, "I want to make the argument in public about things I care about."
Interesting.
And I've been able to
do that.
Because
you're ballsy. I don't. You know, I'm a moderate. And so I'm kind of like Henry Clay, the great compromiser. And I sometimes, when I study history, I think, what would I have done in this situation? And I probably would have looked for a compromise on an issue like slavery in 1840. And that's the wrong side of history.
Right.
You know, I'm not doing it right that way. I'm a compromiser. You know, the women's sports thing, the transgendered sports thing. You know, my sister was a great athlete. And she had no opportunity to play because she was before Title IX. And the first athlete, Mainers will appreciate this, that I saw that was better than my sister was Lisa Blaze Manning. You know, she was the first one I saw that was better than my sister. But anyway, now when I see something like an athlete who was transgendered, and Leah Thomas at Penn beating Riley Gaines keeping, I don't know, did she he keep her off the podium or just win the championship? One time they tied and he got the trophy, Leah got the trophy. And but, you know, what's correct? And I think those are discussions that we have to have. And they're so hard to have in public because you get labeled a hater or you get labeled a, you know, a whatever that is. But I think those are discussions that we should have as a community. You know, what is the best thing? Because certainly, I hate the word cisgendered, a girl has a right to grow up and compete in sports.
Sure.
And shouldn't have to be looking at a podium with three transgendered girls on it.
Right.
I don't think. But, you know, how do we have that conversation? I think that's what America's grappling with right now.
Well, that's the problem, to have that principled conversation. I think you can come to the table with strong beliefs about stuff and still talk about it in a philosophical and intellectual way. But what I found is, because I don't believe that boys who are now girls should be competing against girls. I've just seen it all my life. You know, when the morning show, we were talking about this, and we talked about Usain Bolt. I mean, there's no girl that is ever going to be able to compete with that man. Right. Ever, ever, ever. It's not going to happen.
I did do a little research on that. And across the board, men's records in track are 11% faster than women's records. And, you know, I was talking about FloJo one time. She ran a gold medal performance, Olympic record, world record. And that year, 51,000 men turned in faster times.
Yeah.
Now, that might be one guy eight times, but there were 51,000 times that were faster.
Well, it's like running the 100-yard dash and giving a guy an 11-yard head start.
It
just makes no sense.
Yeah, they don't run the 100 anymore. Right?
I know, it's 100 meters.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I know. Bob Hayes ran the 100-yard dash.
Bob Hayes.
Yeah, he was something else.
There's a man, huh?
Oh, yeah, 1960s Olympics.
Dallas
but, I mean,
Cowboys.
That would be like giving an 11-meter head start.
Essentially,
who would
yeah.
think that is fair?
Yeah.
And so, anyhow.
I don't know that that's exactly. You're right, it's 11% faster. I'd have to do the numbers to see if it would actually be an 11-meter head start, but that's about right.
Yeah, it's about right. Yeah. So no one would think that was fair if you were lining up and the guy was 11 meters ahead at the starting gate. Mm-hmm. And
yet I want that person to be happy. I want Leah Thomas to be happy. But I don't want Leah Thomas to be the women's 500 champion, you know.
Well, I think that there is a compromise here. I don't know exactly what it is. But that compromise starts with having principled conversations. But as soon as someone like me says, I don't believe this is fair, suddenly I'm a transphobe, when I'm no such thing. Now, when it comes to children, I have a different viewpoint on this. But for adults, I believe in freedom. God gave us free will. I believe in freedom. And if somebody's not hurting another person, I believe they should be able to do what they want to do. And if a guy wants to become a girl or vice versa, and they're an adult, that's an adult decision. I don't agree on this where it's little kids doing it. I think it's child abuse. I believe very strongly, you know, the president has said he believes it's okay for an 8-year-old to transition. But, you know, take God out of it. I'm a big God person, but take God out of
I'm
it.
I'm a little God person. And, keep going.
Yeah, I'm a big God person. Everything I do is based
on that. I attend church and I consider myself Christian, but I'm not. I can't quote the Bible. I never understand the stories. I just try to live, you know, with the messages of love that are taught in the churches.
But if you take God out of the conversation and you just look at what they like to say is science and data, the studies have shown there was an exhaustive 166,000 children study about kids that were dealing with transgendered issues. And it said that if there is no medical intervention, most of the children, 85%, grow out of it naturally. And, you know, when you think about it, most things with kids, they grow out of naturally if they're not interfered with. So there's a lot of conversation that needs to happen here. I don't know where we can have it and have it be an intellectual, principled conversation, because it always turns into some political fight.
Well, you can put it on the It Might Just Be Me sequel book.
Actually, this morning I brought that up on the morning show as well. Someone texted in and said, you know, just call it It's Just Me Again.
No, I think you should do it this time. I think it's you.
That's a really good.
It might just be you. No, I don't. We'll work on that.
I think it's you. That's not a bad book title. We got to remember that one. We'll credit you for it if we use it. It turns out I think it's you. Well, that may be right.
I'm good at naming things, by the way.
Yeah.
So I want you to consider that.
Yeah.
I've had good luck naming things.
You have had. You really have had.
Bruce Glazier's Varsity Club.
That was you?
Yeah, I named it.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, Bruce.
Not anybody cares, but yeah.
For the audience, Bruce Glazer was a legendary sports guy here in the state of Maine. That was one of the unique things about you guys at News Center Maine. There was you, Pat Callahan, Cindy Williams, Lee Goldberg, Bruce Glazer,
Joe Cupo.
And Joe Cupo. You guys were there 30 years together.
Well, that front team of Pat Callahan, Cindy Williams, Bruce Glazer, and Joe Cupo was together for 30 years. And I think that was like second in the nation they were finding or something.
It's very unusual. It doesn't happen. Yep. You know, even in a market like this, it definitely doesn't happen.
Well, because this is a market where you jump up.
Right, exactly.
And the problem was our ratings got to be good. We were big number one. We were making enough money that you could stay and raise your family here.
Right.
And so you look at, you know, do I want to go to, you know, pick the next market? It isn't necessarily going to be Boston. You know, it might be, you know, Austin or, you know, I'm trying to think.
Pittsburgh, something
you know,
like that.
Pittsburgh. You know, yeah. Do you want to move your family to Pittsburgh?
No.
A lovely place, but, you know, it doesn't mean anything to me. So, you know.
No, Pat is a great friend, as I think you know, and was on this station for 15 years every Thursday. We would talk about that a lot. Here at our place, Atlantic Coast Radio, where we have sports stations and news talk, everybody here but one person has been here at least 20 years.
Yep.
It's unusual, and particularly in a radio market like this. You may be in radio all your life, but you're not at the same station all your life.
Right.
It's very unusual,
but
it speaks volumes about Maine.
I met J.J. Jeffries, the owner of the station, who I listen to on the radio now, and I think that's J.J. for God's. I met him at spring training in 1978.
Really?
It's impossible.
For the Red Sox?
Yeah.
Oh, that's incredible. Yeah, he's a legendary figure, you know?
Oh.
He was up there with Cousin Brucey and Wolfman Jack back in the day.
Yeah.
Big name, no doubt. But this is an unusual place. That's one of the reasons Dee Dee and I moved here right after we got married. We've been here now 39 years, and we love this state. We love what this state is. I came here not to change it. I came here to embrace it.
Well, we have an ocean. We have lighthouses, we have beaches, we have mountains, we have trails, we have the Allegash Wilderness Waterway, we have Baxter State Park, we have Acadia National Park. I'm not big on Acadia anymore in the summer because it's just too crowded, but we have a lot of great places. And as Bud Levitt once said, there's more beauty in my backyard than there is in the whole province of Labrador, as far as I'm concerned. You know, and I feel the same way.
Yeah.
I'm just as happy on my deck, you know, with a veggie burger as any place in the world.
You know, it is incredible. We own a condo, and we have had a moose in the backyard. We have deer all the time. There's a fox den not far from where we live. Mm-hmm. We get to see all the animals, even though we're in an urban area where we live, not far from the station. But it is scenically beautiful. It's just, we've been here 39 years as of April 30th, and I am still in love with the state, and I'm still mesmerized by it.
I don't know if that's why we think something is beautiful. You know, do we learn that somehow? But I went somewhere, and I was in a different kind of environment. As I get close to home, I got thinking, God, this is beautiful, you know? And certainly for me, this is where I belong. I'm just as comfortable here among the leafing trees this spring day than anywhere in the world for me. And you know, we're going to Alaska in June and that kind of stuff, but you know, I'll be looking forward to getting home. And I don't want to travel in summer anymore either.
Right.
You know, let's go. We went to, you know, Italy and, you know, Provence and stuff. And, why are we sitting here for this kind of money? When let's come here and go Christmas shopping in December or something.
Right, exactly.
You know, I'd rather just sit in Maine in the summer.
We are going out to Milwaukee for a convention in July. And I don't want to leave Maine. Well, I didn't set the dates of the convention. Believe me, if I did, it wouldn't be in July in Milwaukee. But I don't want to leave Maine. Mm. I don't like leaving here. I love it here.
What's the convention? And can I go? I'm trying to get to all 50 states, and I've never been to Wisconsin.
It's the Republican National Convention. You could come
It's in Milwaukee?
Yeah,
you could
come as part of my press team. We were hoping for Nashville. But Nashville decided they didn't want the chaos that's going to happen because it is going to be chaos.
Right, and Nashville's probably full in the summer anyway.
Right.
Right?
Of course. Nashville's a fun... I've never been to Milwaukee, so...
I have been
to Nashville.
Yeah, I like
Nashville. Nashville's a fun place, no doubt. But, you know, this place, there's something special about it. I say this to people, and unless you are from here or you came here and spent your life here, there's something about Maine that gets inside of you, and it matters.
And doing the show Bill Green's Maine, which I did for 20 years, the first segment was Action Adventure. which would be, you know, paddling, running, sailing, jumping, you know, I can't think of what, you know, all the things, snowmobiling, skiing, and we have a tremendous variety, and probably, I guess, every state can do them, but certainly in Maine, we're known for our outdoor recreation.
Sure.
And that was my specialty, outdoor recreation. The second was an interview with an interesting person, and so I got to meet all the newsmakers and prominent politicians and not-so-prominent politicians. And the third segment was something out of the archive, and the fourth segment was storytelling. So I'd find a guy that was interviewing him, that was making clam hose, and interview him. You know, and when I started on TV, unless you'd been to like Harvard, I didn't want to interview you. And pretty soon I discovered people would rather talk to the clam digger.
Right.
You know, you get some guy, you know, whose pants are down around his butt and, you know, is all, you know, didn't shave for 2 or 3 days and they're missing a couple of teeth, telling it like it is. They love him. And so I, you know, that kind of became my claim to fame or whatever, my style, get close to the people. And And that's why it was successful. That's why we had good luck with that show.
Well, that's it. Because, you know, the thing about it is the guy from Harvard's great.
Yeah.
But when you talk to the clam digger, people can relate to him.
Yeah.
Because they're going through the same stuff he is.
Probably, yeah. He's probably going through worse. But,
yeah, well, that could be
you
true.
Know, the guy that went to Harvard's probably got it made. I don't know. But that's something that's going to be interesting, where the Ivies will, how they'll come through this. I imagine they'll come through the recent political chaos quite well. But certainly they've lost they've been knocked down a notch.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that's true, Bill, because if you'll recall,
they've been knocked down?
No, that they will come through it, okay.
Yeah.
As you may recall, three presidents of prominent Ivy League universities were before Congress, and they couldn't say anti-Semitism is wrong. And now they've had a lot of chaos, and some people would call it protest, but I would call it a riot for the shape in which they left the property, that are anti-Semitic in nature. I don't believe most people are anti-Semitic. I don't think they like this. And the way the universities have handled it, where they've placated these folks, instead of just saying, as my university, University of Florida, did, we're not a daycare. You will not do this here.
I read that in the Wall Street Journal. They looked at three colleges, Florida, Northwestern, and I think Columbia. Florida came out looking pretty good on that one.
They
They wouldn't allow that kind of thing. But I mean, we're all for free speech, and we're all certainly for free speech, especially when you're on a college campus. And I think when you're 20, you ought to be allowed to say something really dumb.
Yeah.
But what I was seeing on the college campuses isn't a 20-year-old sophomore from Turner, Maine. You know, I'm seeing something different.
Yeah.
And I don't know exactly what it is, but it's an organized. It's like the graduate students at the University of Maine wanting to organize a union. My wife was a graduate student at the University of Maine, and you know, all right, if you want to pay them $500 because they're teaching two courses, you know, an extra $500, that's fine. But, you know, why would the UAW be interested in organizing graduate unions? And I looked up Columbia just to see. The graduate program at Columbia is a UAW unionized program. So is that someplace where people are slipping in? And I'm a moderate. I'm a pro-choice, pro-life guy. I don't know what else I am. But, you know, I'm not way over on the far right, and I'm certainly not way over in the far left, but, you know, you can't even ask the question is what scares me.
Yeah. You when Susan Collins ran for the United States Senate in 2020, you stepped out.
I came out
and stood up for her, which was, you had never done that before. You and
never.
I talked about it at the time. One, what motivated you to do that? And two, what did it cost you for doing that?
Interesting. I came out because I didn't think she was being treated fairly. You know, having come out of the newsroom a year before, you know, I know what's said. I know who's getting hired. I know what management thinks. And, you know, I didn't think she was getting a fair trip. And her opponent raised the record for Senate spending on a campaign in Maine was $8 million, which Susan had spent the time before, I believe. They were spending $90 million against her, and the arguments were kind of—they weren't kind of unfair. They were unfair. You know, there's an old New Yorker cartoon with Foghorn Leghorn the rooster, right. And the reporters are saying, "You've been characterized as a cheat, a scoundrel, and a philanderer. How do you respond to these charges?" Well, you know, you know what I mean. And
right.
So that was the direction the campaign was taking. That Susan Collins doesn't love Maine. You know, I believe Susan Collins does love Maine. You know, when you grow up here and pick some potatoes, and you know, I just believe she does love Maine. Now she may think differently. The you know, some of her votes you can challenge certainly, but She loves Maine. She's changed. She doesn't like Maine anymore. All this crap. It was just crap. And so I just said, you know, $90 million in an unfair campaign, and it's shameful, and it really was. It was all orchestrated. It was all, you know, and I thought her opponent had a problem in that it was a canned kind of campaign. Mm. I didn't sense a lot of spontaneity. I sensed a bunch of people that came in from out of state, you know, did a blueprint for what the campaign should be, and you know, it wasn't looking very good. And in fact, there were 17 public polls, and they were all Susan was losing, and then the last month we turned it around. And it's funny, the last weekend before the election, they came to my yard to film more commercials, and I said, why are you here? This guy, you know, they have big Washington, D.C. company doing it, which I want those done locally, darn it.
Right,
but, you
of
know,
course.
But anyway, and he said, and I said, does she have a chance? He said, I wouldn't be here if she didn't have a chance. And then she won by 9 points. So
right.
They knew, I think he knew that weekend she was going to win. I didn't know. And so election night, she invited me up to her suite. We went up to Bangor, and I went up, and I'm going to be emotional about this. I went up because I thought she was beat. And I, you know, this is some, you know, stuff my mother and father taught me. You go up and you shake the winner's hand. You walk out on the field after the game. You shake their hands. You say good game, even though you don't mean it. And then, you go pound your head against the wall. You know what I mean? Good game, good game, good game, good game.
Right, sure.
That's what you do. And you know, then you know, the first town that came in was Aetna, and my nephew lives there. And I'm thinking, okay. And it was like 525 to 183. And I'm thinking, whoa. That's not 2-1. You know, that's, what is that, 70, 75? I'm trying to, you know, 535 plus 183 is, you know, 710 divided by, you know, I'm thinking, whoa, that's a big number. But Aetna, 500 votes, what difference does it make? But that was the first indication. The first town came in, and I think Susan had carried it 72-3%. And then, you know, stuff started coming in. And she felt, I don't want to talk too much about what was going on in that room, but she felt that when she carried Lewiston, she had won the election. And on your radio show this morning, somebody said Lewiston is really important.
I did.
I remember thinking that's correct.
Yeah, Lewiston-Auburn. A Republican can't win without it.
She thought she won pretty early in the evening when Lewiston-Auburn came in. And the nicest moment was we're watching some network, CBS maybe, I don't remember, and they called her race about, it was pretty early,
yeah.
And it came up, Susan Collins elected in Maine. And I remember thinking how nice that is for her because the rest of the Senate is seeing it.
Yeah.
And, you know, all this stuff we've heard about, she's going down, and very early on she got a win. So I was glad. And why do I feel good about it? Because, and I'm not for earmarks, like, you know, I'm pro-choice, pro-gay life. I'm not for overspending. But she is the ranking member of the Appropriations Committee, which means she's the top Republican on that committee, which is chaired by Patty Murray of Washington State. Correct me when I'm wrong. She can bring stuff back to Maine. And we are a debtor state. We get more than we are taxed for.
By a lot.
And she's number one in earmarks. Now, philosophically, I'm against earmarks. But if a state's going to get them, I want it to be my state.
Well, of course.
And I'll give you an example. Eastern Maine Community College up in Bangor wants to run a program for EMTs. They're all of the country, I guess, is having trouble with firefighters and EMTs. It's really tough in rural Maine.
Right.
One of, you know, I don't know what it is, $100,000 for an ambulance at Eastern Maine Community College, where kids will get trained in being EMTs. They'll disperse to those small towns all around Bangor, and that's going to save lives for 20 or 30 years. Because we elected Susan Collins, and I feel very good about that. And you go down her list of earmarks, you know, I mean, I'm not for earmarks, but I'm glad she's number one in earmarks.
Yeah.
Am I too hypocritical, Ray?
No. I mean, let's face it, earmarks happen. You can be philosophically against them, but if they're going to happen, we might as well get our cut of them.
Some old legislator sometime, like a Peter Mills kind of guy who now runs the Maine Turnpike, I don't think it was him, but he said, when my father went to the legislature, he went there to get a bridge. You know, we needed a bridge in town. He went to get a bridge. And he worked 2 years. We got a bridge. But now, you know, we're talking about, you know, transgendered people in Arkansas.
Right.
You know, we're too, you know what I mean? I think when the city council comes out and does a resolution against Gaza, they're wasting my tax dollars.
I couldn't agree more.
You know, fix the damn potholes on Main Street.
Right.
You know, let's get the school, you know, I live in a town where the school is very good. Let's work on making the school better. Let's work on making it a little more economical. Let's focus ourselves nationally. But if you're running for school board and, you know, you're into Gaza or something, I think it's crazy.
Yeah, you're just basically abusing your position because right. It's not under your purview. Back to Susan Collins.
Sorry.
No, it's good. I'm glad you said these things.
I'm ranting.
Back to Susan Collins for a moment. I never doubted she would win. Never doubted.
Really?
We actually, Dee Dee and I don't know if you know this, we have a magazine called Richardson Magazine, and I wrote a piece.
It's electronic only, and how can people subscribe to that, Ray?
Well, basically, they just go every month and go to rayrichardson.com, and there it is.
There it is. Okay, rayrichardson.com.
Yeah.
I have to plug his stuff. He doesn't do a very good job of self-promotion. All right,
not.
Keep going.
But I wrote a piece in January of 2020 and laying out exactly why Susan Collins was going to win again. And I never thought for a second. First of all, Sarah Gideon was from New Rhode Island. She had not been here very long. Mm-hmm. She had a lot of very radical ideas. That's number one. Number two, what Sarah Gideon was asking the people of Maine to do is this, to admit they made a mistake, that Maine people had voted for Susan Collins for four terms. And so what Sarah Gideon suddenly did was come to Maine and say, wait a minute, you need to admit you've made a mistake. Susan Collins is not the right person for Maine. And I just never thought for a second they were going to do that because Susan didn't make a major blunder. It's not like Susan Collins had been in the Senate and she had stolen money or she had gotten involved in some scandal or something like that. She never did that. What Susan Collins did is what, and I introduced her recently at the Republican convention and I brought this up. She did what she told me she was going to do in 1996 in the park in my hometown. I will show up every day and represent all of Maine and I will do it to the best of my ability. I will always show up for work. And she has kept her word. By the way, you may know, she recently cast the 9,000th consecutive vote of her career, the longest from the start of a career to never miss a vote.
Which is amazing. But I think that speaks really well of her. And I don't know too much about the inside story, but her mother passed away recently.
Yes.
And they're holding the budget up, 12, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, and she's waiting on that budget vote to fly to Caribou and be at her mother's funeral.
Absolutely.
I mean, can you imagine, you know, and I think it was Cruz or somebody brought up some kind of resolution that had to be passed before they could do the budget because it was some judges that he wanted, and he made them vote on that before that, knowing that Susan couldn't get away.
Well, and you know, again,
it's a tough place down there in Washington.
Yeah, it speaks volumes to her character, though, that she believes so strongly showing up for work, and that's the county work ethic.
That's
we talked about the county earlier. That is the county work ethic.
I'm going to brag about something that I'm not allowed to brag about anymore.
Okay.
I worked 48 years in TV. I was sick 9 times.
Wow.
Now, you can't say that anymore. Think of the people I infected. They were falling down with flu all over the control board when I was there, man. But I didn't take sick days. You know, I took 9 of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was really proud of that. Now I'm not supposed to talk about it because of COVID. But, you know, but I did. I had a cold. I went to work, you know, and I don't know. There's something about a work ethic that I think is very important. Because I don't think I was a very talented guy. I think I just outworked a lot of people.
Yeah, well, that's it. You know? I mean, that's often what happens. You know, same thing for me here. Prior to COVID, other than scheduled days off for a vacation or something, I'd never taken a sick day. And at the time was 17 years. So just don't believe in it. My father taught me you get up and you go to work every day. That's a man's responsibility. Now, women obviously also do it now, but that was my responsibility as the father and the husband.
And what have I lost for the Susan thing? I'm being kind of ghosted by people on the, you know, I'll say the left third.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm not, you know, I'm not.
The fringe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
I
but
know
they carry a lot of weight, you know.
You weren't even at News Center Maine at the time, but they were calling News Center Maine and screaming at them.
Oh, yeah.
Because they would carry reruns of Bill Green's Maine, and they were screaming at him about it. But the fact of the matter is, you stood up for your friend. You had known Susan Collins for a long time.
Since 96. My wife, Pam, had known her even longer because she worked for Bill Cohen. And Pam was in the Banking Trade Association. And Susan would come and speak to bankers. So Pam, when Susan first ran for governor, Pam said, oh, I know her. She's really nice.
Right.
And so that's kind of how I got involved. Then my sister went to work for her.
Well, and I think this is a point that people need to understand. you saw someone that you knew, you'd been friends with for a while,
yeah,
who was being horribly mistreated with a bunch of lies being thrown at her, and you felt like you had to stand up for this person. That was what you were called to do.
Sure.
That's a great example for people, because you had never gotten involved in politics prior to that.
No, and I probably won't again. But, you know, yeah, that's exactly right. I just thought that when you – I'm sick of half a story. I'm sick of – you know, give me a news story, and I'll give you a story where, you know, you're only hearing half of it. You only,
right.
You know, you get to the point where it starts to be interesting, could be a great discussion, and they move on. And I like discussion. You know, I just like to – there are more than two sides to every story, but I'd like to hear at least two of them, and you don't hear that very much anymore. And this advocacy journalism now, talk about your great oxymorons, you know, you got to listen to two stations to get the story.
Right. Yeah, it's too bad. I like the discussion. I probably like it too much, or maybe I like the confrontation. Depends on who you ask. But I do enjoy the give and take of it all. And I wish there was more of it. The problem is that in order to have real confrontation, I don't mean confrontation physically, but intellectual confrontation, you have to actually have a set of rules to go by where people, instead of just sitting there waiting to say what they're going to say, no matter what you say, I'm going to say what I'm going to say. You could be talking about Mars, and I'm going to tell you about a lake in Maine. That's not intellectual discourse. And that's really where we are today. But when people can really go at it, it's fun. It's invigorating.
Yep.
You brought up Henry Clay. That's what they used to do back then.
Yep.
You know, the Compromise of 1850, that was a really hard-fought compromise. And Henry Clay really hadn't made up his mind. He knew what he was trying to do. And then he came to a position. They came up with four different compromises, known as the Compromise of 1850. And then he had to get his great friend, Daniel Webster, who was probably maybe the best orator in all of American history, to stand up and be for it. And he couldn't decide.
And while it was true that it did delay the Civil War, it really was not a good thing to have done. And that would be my problem if I were in there. I would compromise. I would give somebody a little, if you give me a little, and let's try to move on and make it a little bit better place. But that one, I don't know what. Well, slavery had to be ended.
It had to be ended
the way that I guess it had to be ended.
Well, and I don't think it had to be done that way. I think that we could have. But, you know, the South was really entrenched in a certain way of life, and slavery was part of that way of life, and they didn't want to give that up, and states' rights were important.
How long would slavery had gone if we had not fought the Civil War?
Well, Great Britain got rid of it, I think, in 1832.
Yeah, I don't know. But before,
I think that's what it was.
I
think that was it. Was either 1832 or 1837.
And France is on our side because slavery is abominable.
Right.
So how long could the South have endured with it?
Because
I'm talking about a person's life, 25 years.
I don't know
but
how
it,
long.
Could it have made the 20th century?
I don't think it would have made the 20th century. We were moving into a very different. Well, first of all, we were moving into a very industrialized nation, and that was never going to work. Could we have avoided a civil war? Maybe, probably. I don't know. I think the problem was there were a lot of people in the South who didn't own slaves, who found it to be morally repugnant, who through their faith believed this was wrong. But they were afraid. They were afraid to stand up.
Yeah.
And, you know, often what happens in these circumstances, when something's really wrong, but it appears the masses are for it, good people don't stand up. I would love to. I grew up in the South. You know, my great, maybe third great grandfather owned 3,000 slaves. I would love to think that I would have been William Lloyd Garrison of the South and spoke out against it. That's what I would love to think.
Yep.
Don't know if that would have been the case because I didn't live then. But I just am a great believer that if you have a core set of beliefs, you stand up for them no matter what they cost you.
Yeah. But see, with me, you know, I'm such a meaner. I often wonder that myself. Would I, you know, it's pretty hard to fight against your native state.
Yeah.
You know, and I you know, you hear the Shelby Foote quote from the Burns documentary about the Civil War, you know, the rebel who said, "I'm fighting because you're down here."
Right.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I love Civil War studies, but, you know.
It is, you know, the one that was most perplexing to me in all of this was Robert E. Lee. Lincoln asked him to lead the Northern Army, the Army of the Potomac, and he stayed with his state.
Right.
I just have never understood. You know, he fought in the Mexican-American War,
of course,
of 1845, along with the Ulysses Grant. You know, a West Point graduate, a great American.
Yeah.
And when the big moment came, he made the wrong choice.
It's his life.
I can say that
as a
Southerner.
Yeah, no, you're right. He did make the wrong choice.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
You know.
It's interesting.
I mean, if he had stood with Virginia and Virginia says slave will be a slave state or die, but not fought against the Union, then that might have been a different argument. I still would have thought he would have been wrong. But to actually take up arms against the country that he loved, the country that he had fought for, I don't see it.
Interesting.
Okay. I don't see it. I'm a Southern boy. I grew up with all this. You know, a lot of my family, I have a lot of history. You know, it's really very funny. One of the funniest stories of my family is my mother, very much a Southern belle. I mean, she didn't believe in slavery or any of that stuff, but she very much a Southern belle. And so she's from, her mom's from Knoxville, and they were up in Tennessee. And, you know, Tennessee was played it both ways. Part of Tennessee stayed with the North and part went south. So they were doing some heritage like they like to do and walking through the graveyards. And she knew that a couple of her ancestors had been, you know, generals in the American Civil War.
Wow.
And so they went to the graves, and then she was so surprised to find out they had fought for the Union. She was shocked.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they had fought for the Union. And so, you know, I mean, you know, I go back to this all the time. A lot of people think I'm crazy when I say it. I think the most consequential person in this country in the last 170 years was John Wilkes Booth.
That's bizarre, Ray, but keep going.
I think he changed the course of this nation in a way in which, had Lincoln been allowed to live, we would not be where we are today. All this stuff would have been very, very different. As you know, Mr. Lincoln gave in his second inauguration, with malice toward none, with charity for all. Lincoln never saw the South as another nation. He saw it as family that were in a state of rebellion. We all know that. We have family that rebel against the family or whatever, but we still love them. That's how Lincoln viewed the South. And Lincoln was going to let them back in. If Lincoln had been president, we would have never had Reconstruction. We would never had the radical Republicans punishing the South. Lincoln didn't want to punish the South. He wanted to come back into the family. He
wanted to let them up easy.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a wrestling match. Let them up easy.
Absolutely. And
that's Grant, interesting to think about.
Grant showed that same kind of thing with the surrender at Appomattox.
Well, Lincoln had instructed him.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's what I'm saying, though. Had Lincoln been allowed to live, I don't believe we'd be where we are today.
That's so interesting. I think there's so much hatred and resentment. And, I mean, we've been to war. And I think a lot of that was going to take decades to shake down. And Lincoln might not have been as successful as you think. But
well, he may not have been. But one of the things that made it so bad, and if you read a lot of the journals, which I did growing up, is that after the war, they were so severely punished.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they were severely punished. I mean, the radical Republicans put black folks into office that couldn't read and write to run the government. They were so severely punished because they were going to show them, you were wrong and we won, and we're going to basically make you walk in mud, lay in mud. And that's what they did. Lincoln would never have done that. He would never have allowed it.
Interesting.
It is a fascinating conversation. Well, you know, you look at what I couldn't figure out is, and we don't learn lessons very well, but after World War I, Germany was so severely punished.
Right.
Very punitive.
Right.
And it led to the rise of Hitler.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, had Germany been allowed to get back on its feet after World War I, Hitler would never have come along. But the German people, by the time Hitler came along, they were starving. They didn't have jobs. They were cold in the winter. And he came along preaching whatever the hell it was he preached, and they bought it. They were desperate by then. Desperate people will buy all kinds of things.
We're off the rails here, Ray. Who's the next vice president?
That's a really good question.
Who's the next Republican nominee for vice president?
I think the first question was the right question.
Okay.
I have long advocated for Kristi Noem.
She's dead.
However,
metaphorically,
the dog story
kills her.
Probably,
she's gone.
So I love Tim Scott. I admire his story. I love Tim Scott. I love even more, Byron Donalds of Florida.
I don't even know who that is. That's the congressman.
He's a congressman.
He's just emerged a little bit on this in this discussion.
Right? Well, he's emerged a lot, you know, over the past couple of years. He's a big man physically, has a lot of presence. He's a very smart guy. He's a very principled man. And his wife is even more principled than he is. And so I would love to see
her. That doesn't do us any good because she doesn't get a say.
Well,
she gets a say. So.
Well,
I mean, she gets more of a say than, you know, but
she's a person who could be out there influencing, and she's fabulous. I would love to see that. We had this discussion on the morning show before you got here and asking that question. Vern Dukes, who was here earlier, brought up Winsome Sears out of Virginia, and that's a swing state.
Yeah,
she's been a very popular lieutenant governor in Virginia. So that would be a good question. Who do you think is going to be the person?
I don't know, but I've studied vice presidents of all things. And they're all, as you know, they're always picked to balance a ticket, not to be an effective vice president.
Right.
And you could argue, as someone did on your show this morning. Sorry to keep referring to this podcast listeners.
No, that's okay.
But Michael Pence was probably an excellent vice president.
That was me that made
First
that
of
argument.
All, he came up, and on his big moment, he came up with the right decision.
He did.
But who's, you know, the primary responsibility of a vice president, it could be argued, is to serve should the president become incapacitated. And Mike Pence could run the country.
Sure.
Now, he's pretty far right. A lot of people wouldn't want him. But, you know, he could set up a cabinet and run it because he has administrative ability. Where someone like, you know, like maybe Kamala Harris now is much more prepared than she was 4 years ago. But 4 years ago, you know, the idea of her running the country was, you know, a pretty scary thought. That's your cue.
Well, if she is more prepared, she doesn't demonstrate it.
But you know what I mean. So what are you looking for in a vice president? You're not looking for somebody who can run the country because you think you're not going to die. You're looking for somebody who can balance the ticket. And so if you guys define the two most important, the press secretary for the Trump team who was on your show this morning, her name is
Caroline Leavitt.
She said the two big issues are the border and the economy.
Right.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. It's a working studio.
So I would hire somebody who's strong on the border and the economy. Would you hire? Would you select Governor Abbott?
Yeah, you know, Greg Abbott's an interesting choice.
Does he have high negatives?
I'm sure he does because he's been very strong on the border, and there are a lot of people in this country that don't want us to be strong on the border. They think we lack compassion.
Well, those people aren't going to vote for Trump anyway.
Exactly. My attitude on the border is simply this. This is a very generous country. We allow about 1.1, 1.2 million people to come in the country every year legally. It's not as though we've shut the borders and become isolationists. What's happening on the southern border is a tragedy to this country. And frankly, it's a tragedy to the people coming across. Because they get exploited, big companies. Why do you think the U.S. Chamber of Commerce fights immigration reform all the time?
Why?
It's because the members who pay their freight at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce exploit these people. They come in and pay them subpar wages. They work in conditions they shouldn't have to. And these people are just so grateful to be here, they'll take anything.
But that's why. But now the big thing is, the argument is, and it's coming as much from the left as it is from the right, they can't work for the first 6 months.
Which is crazy.
That came from the left. To protect these poor immigrants.
Right.
But now...
Those are legal people. They're the asylum seekers. They can't work for 6 months to 2 years, depending on their circumstance, which is an absurd argument because we let them do anything else they want to do except work. And most of these people that have come here are fleeing... The asylum seekers are fleeing oppression, and they want to live the American dream.
It goes back to a Democratic governor from Maine named Joe Brennan, who died recently.
Yes.
I thought Joe was a great guy. And
I agree with that.
He thought you judged a community, a state, by how it treated its poor citizens, but he also pounded on jobs. Cargo ports, fish piers, potato packing sheds. Joe wanted jobs. And my own family story, my mother immigrates from England. Her uncle came and worked for a year and then sponsored her family. My grandfather came and worked for a year, and he got a job, and he sponsored his wife, my grandmother, and the three or four oldest children, which included my mother. So when that family came and ended up in Cincinnati, they don't even know why, because he was headed for the coal mines of West Virginia and somehow ended up a gardener chauffeur in Cincinnati, but he could support his family.
Right.
It was a flawless immigration, other than they made fun of my mother because she had a funny accent, which she dropped in 3 months. And then she ends up joining the Wax and the Waves. I mean, that's the American story.
Of course it is.
You know, that's the story we want to hear. And we're hearing it now with these young graduates who were allowed to speak, a few of them. You know, I came here. I was from Sudan. And, you know, I'm putting my graduation robe and the mortarboard on my mother because I couldn't have done it without her.
Right.
You know, that's the story we want to support and project, you know, but not, you know, you guys are walking across the border and you're going to sit there sleeping in the gym until we give you a meal. I mean, I've worked a little bit with my church, staying overnight with some immigrants at another local church. And you look at the family, the father's sitting on the bed talking on the phone. The wife, you know, has a thing over her head and isn't talking. And the two boys look as American as my kids did as teenagers.
Right.
They got their hats on sideways. And they don't respect their parents. Their father doesn't even have a job. And they're down in the neighborhood. They're American. The teenagers are Americanizing so fast. You know, they're speaking English well.
To be here.
You know, when you want to talk to the family, you talk to the teenager.
Right.
And, you know, and you think, you know, we've broken up this family in some ways.
We have.
We should take them one at a time. Dad gets a job. You know, mom, you know, however it's going to work. And we send the two kids to school. But you don't make them sleep in a church and then go here for breakfast and there for dinner and come back. You know, I think that program is just so poorly run.
Well, you mentioned former Governor Joe Brennan. He believed as I do, or maybe I should say I believe as he did.
Whichever.
That the best welfare program was a good job.
Absolutely.
He believed people should
have
jobs.
He said that frequently.
Go to work.
You know,
and that's, you know, look, we in this country, we keep hearing from the media, the dishonest media, that we need all these people coming here to fill jobs. We have 40 million Americans who are work eligible, meaning they meet the right age, and they're capable and they're competent. But for whatever reasons, they're not working. Now, is it because they're getting benefits from the government, so they don't have to work? Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, we have diminished the value of work in this country.
Yeah.
We have 350 million people living in this country right now. We have 161 million people who are working. That math does not work long term.
You know, it's funny. I said this many years ago, but your work is, in a lot of ways, your worth. You know, your dad, maybe your mom, you know, but, you know, hey, here's Joe. Hi, Joe. What do you do? You know, I'm a plumber. I'm a doctor. Right. I'm a sportscaster. You know, I mean.
Well, think about this, Bill. Other than your parents, maybe the first time anyone tells you you have any value is when they hire you because they see something in you. They actually, outside of your mom and dad telling you how great you are, it's somebody that you don't even know. You sit down in front of for 10 minutes, and they say, all right, we're going to bring you into the fold. And they're telling you they see something in you. There's self-worth in you. There's dignity in you. And then, you know, the other piece of it is there is dignity in earning what you have. And we rob people of it.
To me, that's right at the core of, you know, like I'm not I don't know. How do you define rich? How do you define wealthy? You know, how do you define the quality of the life you live? And I just agree with that. I think you should work, you know.
Yeah.
I just think you should work.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think innately most people want to until that is beaten out of them. And when I say beaten, I don't mean like physically beaten. I'm talking about the mental anguish of being told day after day, the only way you can survive is for the government to support you. Eventually, that has a psychological effect on you that's very damaging to you as a person.
I had a kid come by trying to sell me to buy into a solar farm, which I did. I don't know if it's a good idea or not. But in his argument, I mean, he said, well, the government will guarantee. And every time he said the government will guarantee, he was dinging himself.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to deal with the government.
Right.
Now I get a Social Security check, so I'm doing it. But
well, you earned that though. You paid into it.
I'd like to think I did, but you know what I mean. It's you know I wanted to speak to him about it. And say, you know, there are a lot of people that don't want to deal with the government.
Right.
You know, I mean the government's nice. I want them to pave my road. I want them to pick up my trash. I want to employ a police department. You know, but I don't want to do. I want to be self-directed.
Reliant. Sure, yeah. Of course. No, well, the government in this country, uniquely among nations, the original intent was to protect our freedoms and protect our rights, and to do the things that we could not reasonably do as individuals, like build roads and build infrastructure and that kind of thing. We cannot reasonably do that as individuals. and the government's gotten out of control now. The founders, I believe this in my heart. I talk about it all the time. I've studied them all of my life. I've read their journals, you know, obviously, all the stuff they published, you know, publicly, like Federalist and that kind of thing. They would revolt against this. They revolted over a 2% tax. Can you imagine? If they were to see what we've done to this,
right.
The Constitution is a document on the restraint of the government's powers. That's why it was designed. That's why the authority and the powers of the government were enumerated, so we could restrain it.
A lot of it is similar to what we're doing with global warming, which I think is a problem. I think the world is getting warmer. I can see it outdoors. I can see species that didn't used to live here. I can just see it. But and we have a Tesla, which we bought just kind of for fun and just to learn about it. And it's a nice car. It's a great car. But am I doing any good? You know, is my buying a Tesla doing any good where China's got 120 coal plants, whatever it is, 1,200 coal plants? You know, or are we just being suckers to this strange, you know, if let's say we get rid of gas vehicles today, how long will temperatures come down?
No.
You know, that's the discussion you're not allowed to have. I'm trying not to use fertilizer, and you know, I'm trying to be a good citizen. I don't want to drive an old beater with no muffler on it, and I'm sensitive to the environment. I like the outdoors, in fact.
Sure, of course.
But am I doing any good? You know, what's the solution here? We never talk about
The answer is a fairly simple one. If we could have, again, an honest conversation. One of the climatologists that I have on the show quite a often is a guy named Dave Dilley.
Mm-hmm.
And he says part of the problem is that we're looking at the climate in too small a time frame. We're looking at it in 350-year cycles. We should be looking at it in 1,150-year cycles. And he has all the data to back it up. And he says we're going into a cooling trend, which is what now people are starting to say. But he said this 5 years ago, that in the next 4 years we'll begin to go into a cooling trend. The planet sort of heals itself. But whether you believe that or not, I do believe in climate change. I just don't believe mankind is the chief catalyst. I think that there are a lot of natural reasons that this happens, you know, volcanic activity and that kind of stuff. But even if mankind was the chief catalyst, the United States could do everything it wants to do. Coal, for the last 4 years, has been at all-time high for use. 4 years in a row. That's the dirtiest way to create energy.
And I don't hear that being reported.
And China uses 53.4% of all coal, and India uses 20.1% of all coal. That's 73.4% of all coal usage in the world. It's the dirtiest way to generate electricity, and unless they get on board, we could go completely carbon neutral, and it wouldn't matter.
That's what I'm wondering. You know, that's what it seems like to me. It was funny when the boat hit the bridge in Baltimore. I say that because I think the boat hitting the bridge in Baltimore and killing six people is funny. I don't think it's funny. But that port, the coal, goes out of Baltimore.
Right.
So we're still mining it.
Yeah.
Which is awful. Mining is awful.
Well,
but we're sending it overseas.
Coal is at an all-time high usage 4 years in a row. So what have they actually done? And so, again, look, if we can be, Dee Dee and I, I'm a traditional valued conservative. I believe in all the great traditions and family values and all that kind of stuff. What is the based word of conservative? Conserve.
Okay.
Dee Dee and I have a very small carbon footprint. We're very modest people.
Yep.
We actually live what they preach at us.
Of
course, I don't get any credit for it because I'm not a climate change, you know,
right.
madman. You know, I thought Janet Mills going down to the UN and preaching climate change was a joke. Maine's obviously carbon neutral. Look at all the trees that we have here. They say,
are we carbon neutral?
Well, studies today show that Maine has more trees than we did in 1820 when we became a state,
right.
because of intentional planning. And I know we do harvesting, but Maine, we have to be. Only 16% of the state is even developed.
Right.
So, and if we get rid of all the carbon, we don't have oxygen because the plants need carbon to generate oxygen. That's just the cycle of way it works.
Yeah, no, I hear you. So how's Janet done as governor?
I'm the wrong person to ask that
okay.
question.
I kind of like her.
And
you know, I like her.
I can,
she's not so far left that I can't see her. You know?
Yeah,
I
mean, yeah. So the answer is I've known Janet Mills since 1998.
Okay.
and I like her. And I know it drives people crazy when I say that, but I do like her.
Oh, she's very likable.
I mean,
she's a very common kind of person.
But for me, she's a radical. I mean, I know you may not think that, but her abortion law, which allows abortion to birth, too radical for me.
Yeah, well, that, you know, can I talk about that?
Yeah, sure.
So Susan's got Judge Kavanaugh in front of her.
Yep.
And they come up with the idea. He tells her that the Roe v. Wade is settled law. Okay, that was the quote that they all used at the time. And then he gets onto the Supreme Court, and he part of the the majority that overthrows Roe v. Wade, which you and I probably see differently. I understand, and I've read it, that it's a poorly written bill, poorly written law that Judge Blackmun did because he wanted to legalize abortion.
Right.
So you've got the Supreme Court legislating a change in our abortion law back in the 70s. So then they overthrow the abortion law. But what happened in Maine? When they overthrew it, it sent it back to the states, as you know, and Maine had basically abortion rights up to viability. And then the legislature advanced it to abortion on demand. Is that what it's called?
Till birth.
You can have it until birth, which I know a majority of people in Maine are against.
Right.
I mean, even, you know, wherever you are, even if you're for abortion, you don't want to see a child aborted 2 days before its due date.
Absolutely.
But that's what we have here now. I don't think physicians would do it, but you know what I mean? So now because of the overthrow of Roe v. Wade, the woman's right to an abortion in Maine has actually been expanded greatly.
So
and yet the left wing is outraged by it in Maine, even though, does that, any of that make sense?
So for me, there are a couple of components here. Number one, you're right. Roe v. Wade was very poorly constructed legal theory. Byron White, who was a justice at the time appointed by Kennedy, wrote a dissent, and his dissent was essentially the foundation of the overturning through the Dobbs decision back in 2022. Yeah. Another layer of this is Governor Mills campaigned on the idea that she would not change the abortion law in the state of Maine. In fact, she pressed Paul LePage very hard, but on three separate debate stages, she was adamant and firm, "I will not change the abortion law." 2 weeks after being re-sworn in, she proposes, and I did the study on it. I gave my first pro-life speech in 1990. It was a big deal for me. I'm very pro-life due to my faith.
I respect that.
So I did the study. It is the most expansive, least restrictive abortion law, not only in America, but in the entire world of countries that have abortion laws. There's no way you could do it more expansive. And so when this
then what Maine has
than
today.
What Maine has. Yep. It's not possible.
Yep.
So when it first came out, people were like, no, you're making it up. There has to be a medical reason. And there is not in the language of the law, which is what actually matters. But Janet Mills was finally very timidly asked by a reporter, "Why is there no medical language?" And she said very clearly, "I did not want this to go to court and have a judge decide it. So this is merely under this law, a doctor can sign off on it." Well, then people are like, "Well, Ray, why don't you trust doctors?" I said, "I trust my doctors. But if you go to the state licensing board website and you look at how many doctors have either been suspended or had their license revoked for aberrant behavior, how all of a sudden did they become the magical people that we have to trust every word they say when so many doctors in the state of Maine have either been suspended for bad behavior or had their license outright revoked?" So, again, I think what Mills did in that situation, and I find it most egregious of all of her actions, for me, it was just so beyond the pale of reason. You don't abort a baby till birth. Have the baby. If Janet Mills wanted to do something for Maine, change the adoption laws so it's easier for loving couples. I know many, many people who would love to have a child but can't for whatever reasons, and they would adopt a baby in a heartbeat. We didn't even think about dealing with that because abortion is a political issue.
Yeah, it is. And it's a loser for Republicans.
Well, only because Republicans can't figure out how the hell to talk about it.
Right.
I mean, if I were to run for governor, I would talk about it and I would explain my position. First of all, I don't believe that you can get rid of abortion through legislation. I've never believed that anymore. And we've gotten rid of murder, carjacking, domestic violence. So you could pass a ban on all abortions. They're still going to happen. We've got to shift the paradigm and basically help women. If this is a choice, and I don't believe it is, I think that, you know, you're pregnant, you take the baby to term. But we need for women to be able to understand that there are all kinds of private organizations that will help them provide a medical, financial, spiritual care, help them adopt the baby if they cannot raise the child themselves. But we don't ever talk about it from that standpoint. There's a very compassionate message here that I believe Republicans could talk about. But most Republicans, they look like somebody that, you know, there's a blank stare when you ask them. And it's like they've never heard of the word, much less thought about
it. Well, I think it's a, you know, I want to be on the record and say that I support a woman's right to abortion up to viability. You know, and right now, I mean, I'm not going to go out and fight the abortion, battle. But I do think most Mainers, if asked, would think that what we currently have is extreme.
Yeah. If I were governor, I would absolutely repeal that bill. What will we do legislatively?
Well, can a governor see? And that's my next question. So now in Maine, it's legal, but would a doctor perform an abortion 8.5 months into the pregnancy because of the mother's mental health, for example? Would that happen? Could that happen?
Well, it could happen.
Is it happening?
I don't know the answer to that question.
And I think
one of the things they took away was reporting stuff. So we don't know exactly. Could it happen? Absolutely, it could happen. Would a doctor do it? I don't know. You know, there are some doctors. If let's say it's a doctor that doesn't have a faith in God, that believes mankind's it, and until that child is born, it's not a baby. If a doctor were to believe that, then a doctor could conceivably perform that abortion and have no conscience issue.
Would the institute? Would the hospitals allow it?
You know, well, it's the law of the land, so I mean, getting into
could a... Could hospitals not allow it? I mean, if a woman comes in and says, I can't bear this child,
right?
Does the hospital have to do the abortion?
I don't know that answer.
So I don't know,
I
don't know either.
Until that's challenged legally, I don't know. But, I mean, we do have a law here about denial of care, and you have to provide care. Does that apply here? I don't know that answer, and I think that will be challenged.
My point, before it gets challenged in court, is those would be great stories for the media to be doing. But the media, for some reason, can't. And I think it's because you can't. I mean, these are hard issues that should be dealt with before we vote.
Well, the media in Maine, Bill, and you may not like this, but I believe it in my heart, the media in Maine is afraid of Janet Mills. I absolutely. They refuse to write... you know, the stories about Paula Page were replete. We all know that. They refuse to write a single story that is even constructively critical of Janet Mills. There hasn't been one. They don't go after her for anything. They don't even ask her hard questions. Now, I think part of it is she's not very accessible. And so in the limited access she provides, they don't want to lose that.
Yep.
But that's no reason not to ask the hard questions.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't think you have to get Janet to do a story about abortion. I think those are enterprise stories that I think they're very interesting. I think it's part of a discussion. Most of the questions that we vote on are never thoroughly discussed.
They're not. No, it's so, and a lot of it is. I just believe. I mean, Bill Diamond sat where you're sitting right now, and he said,
"Oh my gosh,
ago,
I'm honored."
Yeah,
six or seven years ago now,
he said, "Yeah, exactly." One of the great people of Maine. There's a Democrat I'd support for governor in a heartbeat.
I like Bill.
In a heartbeat.
I think the world.
And we don't agree on everything, but he is a principled human being, and I admire him and respect him, and I would support him in a heartbeat very publicly. But I think Bill sat there where you're sitting maybe 6 years ago, 2018, however long ago that was, and said Janet Mills is tougher than an old barn nail, and people don't like to mess with her. And I think that...
Good for you, Janet.
Yeah, and I think that the media in Maine is afraid of her. I really do.
I think the media in Maine, it depends, but, I mean, it's changing. You know, I mean, it's younger. It's, you know, certainly the television media is...
Well, look at News Center Maine. They're all people that are young enough to be my kids.
I watch all three, and, I mean, they're skewing younger. And I think what's happened, because the stations are corporate, you know... it's an entry-level position now where they used to start in Bangor or a small market and move into Portland. And now they're just coming out of broadcasting school. And another change is they're multimedia journalists. So they're shooting their own stuff, writing their own stuff, and editing their own stuff. And they're even doing live shots on their own.
Right.
I think there's a safety element there that I don't like. But, you know, so you're... 22. You're 1,400 miles from home. You can't even pronounce Steuben. And here you are going live on the 6th. You're lucky to get a minute and a half on the air. And, you know, the say what you want about photographers. I remember as a young guy, you'd go into the governor's office, and the photographer knew the governor.
Right.
Hey,
sure.
You know, right. Scott, Steve, Barry, how you doing? You know, they'd talk, and, you know, they knew what door to go in. They knew how to drive there. They knew where to get a sandwich in Augusta. But if you're off on your own and you're going 75 miles in a company car and you're not even, you got to use Waze to get there, that's a big
It's a big ask.
Big problem.
Well, for example, we went to Cleveland and broadcast the RNC 8 years ago.
Okay.
We're going to Milwaukee. And then when Trump won in 17, we broadcasted his inauguration about 60 feet from the president. Mm-hmm. I brought in the muscle. I flew my brother in from Florida, and he did the stuff with me. You can't go out in public by yourself. You're vulnerable at that point. If you're focusing on your job, you don't know what someone else is doing around you.
Right.
And he's not really the muscle, but he comes up and he broadcasts with me. I do need another person with me. And
I almost got in a fight at the World Series in 2019. Jess Gagne was doing something.
Yeah.
And, you know, these drunks were just coming by screaming.
Right.
And I pushed a kid. I mean, you know, I shouldn't have. I was wrong. But,
right.
You know, get out of here, you dope.
Exactly.
You know, but we had a photographer. And, you know, I could at least watch her back a little bit. But, you know, some of those scenes, we had national conventions and stuff. But even, you know, you just don't know who's out there. And they see a little kid on the side of the road doing a stand-up. Why not?
You don't know. Well, you saw that reporter. Where was it, in Virginia or wherever? And a guy literally killed her on air.
Might have been Kentucky.
It might have been Kentucky. Yeah, but they literally killed her on air. She was standing there on the sidewalk, and just so. I mean, the world's changed.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. And the world's more violent, no matter what anybody says.
Yeah.
And a part of it is, I think, in this country, we broke down the nuclear family, so kids don't have two parents raising them at home and teaching them boundaries and that kind of stuff. So today people think they should just be able to do whatever they want to do. But, you know, I've always said, as you're an adult, I don't care what you do as long as you're not hurting somebody else. But when you hurt someone else, it's now my business.
Well, I agree. I agree with that fundamentally.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the poor reporter, it's a tough job that they're being given now.
Of course.
Because they've saved on photographers by having one-man bands.
Yeah.
What we call a one-man band. And, you know, it's just cheaper.
It's a tough job because things have gotten so vitriolic in politics or covering the news. It's a very tough job. I agree with that. You have set the record, sir. This is the longest podcast I've done so far.
I'm sorry.
No.
How long do we go?
This has been incredibly enjoyable. We've gone 82 minutes.
You're kidding.
I couldn't believe it either when I looked over.
Now I got to ride 5 extra miles on my bike when I listen to it.
Well,
hey,
thanks,
Ray.
This is fabulous.
82 minutes.
Yeah. Jeez. I mean, we just sat
we're
here
not
just
that
thought.
Interesting either, so, jeez.
Yeah. Well, you are.
We'll see.
Yeah,
we'll
you
see
are. You're that interesting, obviously, because
hey,
we sat
Maine,
here and did it.
I miss you, Maine.
Yeah, we miss Bill Green, too. Well, that's why we have you on this station every now and then, to have you come back and just remind everybody of the magic of Bill Green.
Good to see you.
Bill, I really appreciate you being with me. Thank you so very much. This concludes the 16th podcast of It Might Just Be Me. You can catch it on all podcast platforms. And if you want to check in the morning show, you can do that at WLOBradio.com. I am on from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern.